Boker Tov, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Mintz. You see us here, ready to go with part three of our series on snapshots of American Orthodoxy, and we're up to 1971, when we were both little boys. So, Bavakasha, Rabbi Mintz, it's all yours.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Good morning, everybody. Happy Father's Day. First of all, I just want to thank everybody who communicated with me after my talk about Maimonides School. It seemed like that got some interest from people actually who are experts on this topic, either people who went to Maimonides or taught in Maimonides or who knew specific things. I appreciate that. The Rabbi Soloveitchik did write at least one letter, maybe two letters, that were very much in support of co-education and women and girls / women learning Gemara. So I correct the fact that I said that he wasn't explicit about it. It's interesting. I still stand by the fact that he didn't make a big deal about it. There was no correspondence with the school, you know, with the parent body and things like that. I think that's important in its own right. But for my third and final lecture of this series, I want to talk about something else. I want to look at one year in American Orthodoxy. And I want to really focus on that year and try to understand, and you will see in a few minutes why I choose that year. That year is 1971. That's 49 years ago, but 1971. First of all, what's America like in 1971? So the flippant way that people talk about the 70s is that the hippies of the 60s put on three-piece suits in the 1970s. That some of the radicalism, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, early feminism, kind of evolved into a more, you know, basically that generation grew up and they became much more part of the establishment. I'm not sure how many people have been watching online. I know that people choose now online, us too, you know, to watch series. And one of the series that's on, I don't know, Hulu or one of those things, is called Made in America. It's about the women's liberation movement, about the movement to try to get the ERA passed. And it really tells you a lot about the late 60s and early 70s. So that was a time when very much some of the radicalism of the 60s became the establishment of the 1970s. But I don't want to overstate that. The idea of the idea of feminism and you know, trying to get the ERA passed was very much a movement of the 70s. There was still a lot of that feeling of radicalism that went into the 1970s. But what about Orthodoxy? I mean, were there Orthodox protests? Was that the kind of feeling within Orthodoxy? So in terms of feminism, and this is a topic which I'm sure people have spoken about, but the Orthodox feminism really happened later. I think when we talk about Orthodoxy and the 1970s, we need to really reflect backwards to the 1950s and 1960s. And in many ways, the post-war decades were extremely difficult ones for Orthodoxy in America. With the end of World War II, began in earnest the suburbanization of America. We identify it with Levittown, but you know it happened in cities across North America. And what happened with suburbanization was really the growth, the bursting of the conservative movement. You see, the conservative movement, it was easier to be conservative in the suburbs than it was to be Orthodox. Why is that? Well, in 1950 and then finally officially in 1960, the conservative movement allowed for driving. Now, they interestingly only allowed for driving to shul, which probably ultimately, you know, created a huge amount of problems for the conservative movement. But think about if you live in the suburbs. Number one is you're allowed to drive to shul. Number two, we know that the billboards in America in the 1950s, they had a saying. It says, the family that prays together stays together. Now, that billboard was really for the Protestants, but it applied to the Jews as well. The idea of no mechitza, of the family that prays together stays together, was very much an American idea. The idea of youth groups and Sunday softball leagues and, you know, were all very much part of the conservative movement. The Orthodox were still very much in an old-fashioned kind of way. You know, for them, the Young Israel movement, in which they sang songs, was considered to be creative. So it's not surprising that the Jewish sociologist Marshall Sklar was most famous among them. They predicted, when they wrote in the 1950s, that the conservative movement was the future of American Judaism, and that Orthodoxy was going to die out in America. And truthfully, in the 50s and early 60s, it really looked that way. What changed? So the answer is, I mean, and this, it's a hard thing to answer. There are a few things that came together, and it's hard to know which actually was the, you know, which was the driving force. Number one, in the late 50s and early 60s, the Orthodox rabbis, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Feinstein, they came out very strongly, please mute, they came out very strongly against mixed seating in shul. Rabbi Soloveitchik famously said, if the only place you can hear shofar blowing is at a shul without a mechitza, it's better not to hear tkiya shofar. Now, I don't know if that's a halachic decision or that's a sociological decision, but that's what he said in the late 1950s. They basically drew a line in the sand, and they said that if you're Orthodox, you cannot daven in a shul without a mechitza. Number two, and this may be more significant, in 1960, when the conservative movement, when the rabbinical assembly officially allowed driving to shul, that was a point in which the Orthodox said, listen, we cannot associate with the conservative movement. We need to separate ourselves from the conservative movement. So mechitza and driving to shul. I forgot to say that you have to understand that in the 50s and 60s, these conservative shuls felt very Orthodox. The sitter that they used was an Orthodox sitter. The tunes that they used were Orthodox tunes. So when you went in and davened in a conservative shul on Shabbos morning, you felt totally at home, except that you were all sitting together. Yeah, the tripartite is part of it, but they didn't. That's more complicated. They had mixed seating. There actually was a term that was coined for this period. It was actually called conservadox. It was the conservative and the Orthodox together. And that made, that you see, that was the key to the movement, because conservadox allowed the Orthodox to come into the conservative shuls and to feel comfortable, to feel at home. They could feel as if somehow they were maintaining the traditions of what they grew up in without violating something all that terrible. But the minute that Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein said that, you know, to daven in a shul without a mechitza, it's better to stay home. And then when the conservative movement said you could drive to shul, something that any Orthodox Jew was, you know, that was just kind of poison to them. The Orthodox Jews were willing to do a lot of things. They were willing to go into a conservative shul where there was mixed seating. They were willing to do all of those things, but they were not willing to get into a car on Shabbos. So number one, that made a huge difference in terms of separating the conservative movement from the Orthodox movement, or maybe what I should say, separating Orthodoxy from the conservative movement. Number two was the Six-Day War. That is not a small thing. The Six-Day War, brought a sense of kind of messianic fervor even to the Jews of the United States. And it made Orthodox Jews, you know, it made you feel the more messianic that you were, the more Orthodox, the more traditional that you were, the better that it was. But that's also not exactly right. I'd say that more specifically. And that is, today, we're used to the fact that our children spend a year in Israel after high school. Some of us, depending on your age, also spent a year in Israel after high school. When did that phenomenon begin? That phenomenon began in the 1970s, really in the mid-70s. But it started after the 67 war. Before 1967, literally, you could count on a few hands the people, the young men and young women who went to spend a year in Israel after high school or during college. But after the Six-Day War, all of a sudden, more and more people went to study in Israel. This is before there was a Yeshivat HaRetzion, before there's a Gush. Many people went, the boys went to study in Keren Biavne, and the girls slash young women used to study in Michlala or Machon Gold. Michlala was just opening now after the Six-Day War, or Machon Gold. Now, why is that important to spend a year in Israel? It's important in terms of Zionism, and it's an interesting study how many of these people, how many of those early people who spent a year in Israel actually moved to Israel. But I'm interested in something else. We know it today too. When your kid spends a year in Israel, they come back what? They come back more religious, okay? There's been so much written about this, how long they stay religious, what it means that they're more religious. That's beyond my pay scale right now, right? That's not for our topic. The point really is that they come back more religious. So the more people who go to Israel, the more religious they're going to come. Believe me, when they went to Israel for a year and they came back, they weren't davening conservative shuls anymore. Because in Israel, they didn't have this phenomenon. And therefore, they came back and they wanted to be Orthodox. So piece number one is the division, the mechitza and driving to shul. Piece number two is Israel. Piece number three, and this is an important piece and very relevant in terms of Rabbi Lamb, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. And that is the importance of Yeshiva University. Now, Yeshiva University was around since 1927, Yeshiva College, and it was a university since the 1940s. Michael Feldstein is on this call, and I can say that our grandfather got smicha from Reitz, from the Rabbi Yitzchak Kahn Rabbinical Seminary in 1923 or 1924, and he was a rabbi for 50 years in Brooklyn. So so Reitz was around for a long time. But the 60s and 70s was an extremely important moment for Yeshiva University, where young men and women were studying Yeshiva University, where they would meet one another and this is the most interesting part of all, in set mixers, right? In get-togethers. They wanted the YU students and the Stern students to get together to meet one another and to go out on dates and to be married. Now, this is important because these young couples are going to be Orthodox. Because if you take a young man from YU and a young woman from Stern College, they're going to be Orthodox. And therefore, in the early 1970s, what you had was really the first generation of young Orthodox couples. You know, the 60s and the 70s, Orthodox men marrying Orthodox women and all moving to similar communities. I might have mentioned in one of my lectures the fact that, this was the moment where Erevin began to be built. One of the first Erevin was in Kew Gardens Hills in 1973. Kew Gardens Hills is important because Kew Gardens Hills was one of those early young modern Orthodox communities where these young modern Orthodox couples went. They had children. They wouldn't imagine davening, carrying on Shabbos. West Hempstead was another example. Muncie was an example. Teaneck was an example, and I'm sure there are many, many others. So that's also a very important point. The strength of Yeshiva University and the creation really of a generation of modern Orthodox. Now, one of the people, and it might be argued the main person, though this also is a complicated question, who made modern Orthodox viable as a movement was Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. Rabbi Lamb became the rabbi, and he was never actually the rabbi of the Jewish Center because Rabbi Young was retired in 1958. I think he was 70 in 1958. Rabbi Young was there when Rabbi Lamb came in 1958, and Rabbi Young was still there when Rabbi Lamb was appointed president of YU in 1976. Rabbi Young died only in 1986. So Rabbi Young was always there, but Rabbi Lamb played a very important role in terms of making modern Orthodoxy a relevant movement ideologically. What do I mean? Rabbi Lamb was able to articulate, and I'm sure all of you have heard and listened, you know, and read over the past few years, the few weeks, sorry. Rabbi Lamb was the Darshan's Darshan. No one spoke, no one delivered sermons as beautifully and articulately as Rabbi Lamb did. And Rabbi Lamb used to talk about these issues, about how relevant halacha was to modern Orthodox Jews in those years. And I, I gave you the wrong thing. Sorry. You don't want my Parsha class from last year, I don't think. Here we go. Rabbi Lamb, as you know, the Lamb Legacy is available on the Yeshiva University website. Here's a sermon delivered by Rabbi Norman Lamb in the Jewish Center, May 8, 1971. The first important thing to know is that Rabbi Lamb did not speak on Shabbos morning from a written text. He spoke from notes. He typed his sermons on Saturday night. How relevant should halacha be? Now, that's an amazing question in 1971. In 2020, that would be a boring sermon because the Orthodox community accepts the fact that halacha is relevant. In this pandemic, you wanted to know what the halacha said. You looked at Rabbi Schechter. They were waiting for the tshuvas, right? Can you have a Zoom Seder? Halacha was relevant. But in 1971, this was the question that he asked. It is common today to hear demands in all segments of the population that religion be made relevant to the great public issue of our time. Jews have been no less insistent than others in pressing this demand upon the teachers of Judaism. Orthodox Jews too, especially the young, ask that the halacha be examined so that it yield decisive opinions on the critical problems of our day, from Vietnam to Black Panthers, from the World Court to Soviet juries. Rabbis are often berated for failing to pronounce on such issues in the name of halacha. Okay? How relevant is halacha? And what's his answer? Here we go. Halacha touches every area of life and offers its judgment in an attempt to sanctify life by making man God conscious. However, it does not presume to cover all of life and every aspect of it. Most of the specific decisions that you and I will make within the next few days are neutral or indifferent to halacha. The decision whether you will take a bus or taxi to work, what you will sell or buy, the color suit you will wear, whether you will stroll up Central Park or Riverside Drive, whether your children will join one youth group or another, or neither. You make hundreds of decisions every day which are not germane or of concern to the halacha. This is the way it is, and this is the way it should be. Now, that's such a simple statement. You know what's amazing about that statement? What's amazing about that statement is the fact that Rabbi Lamb makes that statement in 1971. That's the issue in 1971. What's the role of halacha in our lives? These are Jews who are not quite sure. You see, in the 50s and 60s, and you know, Jews were fighting to become Americans. Jews were fighting to become Americans. Jews were going to college and Jews were going to graduate school and Jews were getting jobs as professionals. Jews were struggling to, you know, to be able to take off early on Friday afternoon to, you know, for Shabbos and for Yontif. And again, Nat Lewin's on this call, and Nat Lewin was the most important person in terms of fighting for Jews to be allowed something that we, of course, take for granted now, the ability to take off early on Friday afternoon for Shabbos. Nat Lewin was the one who really promoted that in those early years. That was what Jews were fighting for. And that's what they were thinking about in 1971. You know, we're Americans. We made it in America. We're professionals. Now, what role does halacha have? You know, why should we come to shul? Why should we keep halacha? And that's what Rabbi Lamb decides to speak about. What you learn, and I encourage everybody to just flip on Lamb Legacy, it's called, L-A-M-M Legacy. And that is a collection of Rabbi Lamb's sermons. Just flip through them. You don't have to read them carefully. They're jewels. They're amazing. They're diamonds. But just to see the type of topics that he talked about and think about, you know, who he was speaking to. I'll just tell you that Rabbi Lamb told me once, that when he came to the Jewish Center in 1958, there was no Eruv in Manhattan, according to anybody, in 1958. Rabbi Lamb told me once that when he came to the Jewish Center in 1958, the first Shabbos he came to the Jewish Center, the lobby was filled with baby carriages. Halakha wasn't relevant to them. They came to shul because it was social. Halakha was not relevant to these people. And that's what Rabbi Lamb fought for all those years, to make halakha relevant to the Jewish people. And that is something that I think is really, really important when we think. Again, I chose 1971. That was Rabbi Lamb's sermon. But these were the years, I would say the 1970s, maybe a little bit into the 1980s, when modern orthodoxy, as we know it, a movement in which halacha is relevant to modern Jews who have finally found their place in American life, in American professional life, this is the key moment in that transition. And I think we can find that expressed the best way possible in a kind of funny source. That source is the Yeshiva College Yearbook of 1971. Yeshiva College Yearbook of 1971. Why do I mention that yearbook? Well, the Yeshiva University Library is closed now, I'm sure. But when it's open, if you call the librarian and ask the librarian to pull out the yearbook from 1971 from the shelves, I want to tell you something. That yearbook does not appear on the shelves of the Yeshiva University Library. If you look hard enough, you can find it online, because you can find everything online. But it's not on the shelves of the Yeshiva University Library. Actually, the 1971 yearbook of Yeshiva College was banned. Now, what's that about? First of all, just to give you a sense of who was in that class. So among other people, Rabbi David Silber was in that class. Rabbi David Silber, the founder of Drisha, was in that class in 1971. But I don't tell you that for this. He wasn't the problem in 1971. The problem actually related, and this is funny because many of you know this person as well, and the problem revolved around this person right here. Some of you may recognize him. That is Heshy Billet. We call him Rabbi Billet. He's been the rabbi of the Young Israel of Woodmere for over 30 years, for over 40 years maybe. The Philip Lieberman Memorial Award is presented annually by the graduating class to the senior it considers highest in character and personality. And it was offered outstanding service to his class. This year, the class of 1971 has chosen Heshy Billet of Brooklyn, New York, as the recipient. A Reed student majoring in history, Heshy served as the president of SOY, which is the student organization of Yeshiva, in his senior year. In a school where motives are always under the heaviest scrutiny, Hesh has displayed honesty, sincerity, and a selfless devotion to the service of his school and the Jewish community. That's nice. That's super nice. Rabbi Billet actually wrote an essay in that yearbook of 1971. I'm going to read it because it does appear online, but it's hard to read. So just listen for a minute. Today, Rabbi Billet wrote, I fear for my dream. Storming doubts disturb its tranquility. Has my dream been a fantasy? Does profane reality desecrate the yeshiva of my dreams? Has it placed the secular idol of Mada on a pedestal, making but a poor attempt to maintain the facade of a Torah institution? Is the yeshiva I attended, nothing more than a large theater filled with many actors? If so, who and where are the producers of this colossal production? Are the Batei Medrash and classrooms merely stages where professionals and amateur actors lethargically go through the motions of a tedious daily script whose content never changes. Has it placed the secular idol of Mada on a pedestal, making but a poor attempt to maintain the facade of a Torah institution? Heshy Billet, in 1971, is writing, as the recipient of this award, that basically Yeshiva University has given up on Torah, that Torah is secondary to Mada. The Torah is secondary to the secular studies, to the importance of becoming successful professionals. And he says, that's a tremendous shame to that Yeshiva University has come to this point. Now, what's interesting to me is two things. Number one is it's absolutely fascinating that Yeshiva University chose to ban this yearbook. What that shows is that this was an extremely sensitive point. You see, the question is Yeshiva University, let me just take a step back. Dr. Belkin used to say that YU is Valuzhin in the morning and Brown in the afternoon. You could say Harvard, I think he has his doctorate from Brown, so he said Brown. Valuzhin in the morning and Brown in the afternoon. Now, that's nice to say, and for the Jews of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, that was fine. It means that we want to be the best. We want to be Valuzhin, and we want to be Harvard. But in 1971, Rabbi Billet identifies a moment where you can't get away with those kind of mottos anymore. In a sense, you have to decide which is primary and which is secondary. And what Rabbi Billet is arguing is that all the Dr. Belkin years, right? 1971 was still Dr. Belkin's time. All the Dr. Belkin years were Valuzhin in the morning and Brown in the afternoon. But actually, you know, what was important was that we were Brown. What was important was that we were Yeshiva College, but we could become professionals. We could go to fancy, professional schools, and we could get respectable jobs. That was what was important. And what Rabbi Billet says in 1971, and again, Dr. Belkin is the president until 1975, and Dr. Lamb becomes the president in 76. What Rabbi Billet says is that's not going to be satisfactory anymore. We have to decide which is primary and which is secondary. And his criticism of YU is the fact that Torah has become secondary and secular studies has become primary. And he's saying, that's not the yeshiva that I love. The yeshiva that I love has Torah primary and secular studies secondary. And what I say is that blows my mind that in 1971 they were having that argument. You can look and look and look. You're not going to find that argument before 1971. This was a moment 50 years ago, 49 years ago, where actually they began to make this argument. They began to say, yes, it's important to be professionals. It happens to be that Rabbi Billet didn't go into a profession. They didn't go into a secular profession, sorry. He went into the rabbinate. But the bottom line is, this is the first time that you're actually having this conversation about the fact, yes, it's important to be professionals, but Torah needs to remain primary. This was the moment where they had this argument. And Yeshiva clearly was super sensitive to this. The suggestion that Yeshiva was not doing a good job in this way was something that caused them to take this yearbook off the shelves. They didn't want anybody to know that this was the battle that was going on in Yeshiva. Now, today, obviously, you're not going to hear these kinds of discussions. Today, the arguments that you're going to hear are trying to find a place for secular values within a Torah world. What, you know, what's the role of, you know, today, Black Lives Matter, of LGBTQ issues within yeshiva? It's the opposite argument. We all know that Torah is primary. The question is there room for these kinds of secular values and, you know, and morals to be part of the conversation? But what you see from Rabbi Lamb's sermon and from Rabbi Billet's column is that in 1971, it was exactly the opposite. They were arguing for the primacy of Torah over Mada in the sense that Mada needed to be defined by Torah, by Halacha. That was the beginning of the change that leads us to this movement today. Now, again, you can ask Rabbi Billet. You can send him an email and ask him what, you know, how he feels about modern Orthodoxy in Yeshiva University today. I don't know the answer. You know, and Rabbi Lamb, you know, I'm not sure how he felt at the end of his life. That's a good question. You know, did they feel that they were successful in their push in the early 70s, or did they feel that kind of the Yeshiva University community went too far? But what I want to just identify, and these are always, to me, the turning points are always what's interesting. Meaning, I know what Orthodoxy looks like today. I know what Orthodoxy looked like in the 50s and 60s. But looking at this one year, 1971, is absolutely fascinating in terms of trying to understand, you know, what did that transition, what did that challenge to the status quo, what did it look like? We see it in Rabbi Lamb's sermon. We see it in the development of the modern Orthodox community. And I think we see it mostly in Rabbi Billet's, you know, presentation of what's primary and what's secondary within the Yeshiva University community. I want to stop now just for a couple of minutes, because what I did at Rabbi Kelman's suggestion is I did not take any questions because I wanted to wait, but I see there are so many questions that I want to make sure that I give everybody a chance. So I think some of these questions are really interesting. I just didn't want to talk about them yet. So let me just go through one by one. You're welcome to follow in the chat box. They are letting people fly. That's for Jay Kelman. I don't think Rabbi Soloveitchik thought he had to give reasons to the parents. In the early days, it was his tomchim related the derech. Okay, fine. But that's back to last week. There were many synagogues with tripart seating. That is correct. Okay, that was a compromise, and that's interesting. The tripartite, which means there was a men's section, there was a women's section, and there was a mixed section, is an interesting phenomenon as well. Correct. Many conservative movement now feel the decision to allow driving to shul was wrong and didn't have the effect they hoped for. There was a very interesting conservative Judaism forum. I don't know when it was, maybe in the year 2000, 40 years after the decision to allow shul, allow driving to shul, in which many of the conservative rabbis were, you know, said that was the downfall of the conservative movement. What that did was, just to take 1 second to discuss that, when the conservatives allowed driving to shul on Shabbos, it didn't destroy the conservative shul. Maybe it saved the conservative shul. It destroyed the conservative neighborhood. Conservative Jews didn't all need to live together. And what modern Orthodoxy, and I don't need to tell all the people who live in modern Orthodox suburbs, what the strength of modern Orthodoxy is the modern Orthodox suburb, the modern Orthodox community, and that the conservative movement never had. Correct. More religious and perhaps more rigid, seeing the world more black and white, of course. I was in KBY in 1963-64. You win the award. There weren't many there. Several years before the Six-Day War, and that same year, many girls went to Machon Gold. The only thing I would say differently is I don't know that the word is many, and I'd be interested to know who was in KBY with you in 63-64. What about Bravender's? Bravender's is much later. Three powerful Orthodox speakers, of course, Rabbi Lookstein, of course, Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein, of course, was an extremely powerful speaker. It also isn't for now, but there was a difference between Rabbi Lamb and Rabbi Lookstein. They represented different generations. Rabbi Lamb was a younger generation, and therefore Rabbi Lookstein probably would never have, you can ask Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, but I don't think his father ever would have delivered a sermon, is halacha relevant. He wanted to make Upper East Side Jews feel good about Orthodox, feel as if they can be proud Orthodox Jews. Halacha was less of a concern for Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein, though everything's more complicated than a one-second answer. Also, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. Now, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, if you're interested in the Rabbi Yitz Greenberg conversation, so Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, there was an amazing conversation between Seth Farber and Zev Elif. If you Google Zev Elif and Seth Farber, which on YouTube, which I'm sure you can find very easily, about Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and YU. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg was controversial in YU from the very, very beginning. He had a very, very famous set of debates in The Commentator in 1966 with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And so he was never really a factor within Yeshiva University. Now, that in itself is its own story, an important, maybe a tragic story, but an important story. But he was not a factor in Yeshiva University. Rabbi Lamb's uncle, Rabbi Joseph Baumol, the Crown Heights Yeshiva in the 1950s and 1960s, was also a brilliant orator. His style was very similar to that of Rabbi Lamb. We can assume that Rabbi Lamb learned from him. That is actually what they say to Paul Jacobs. What they say is that Rabbi Lamb learned from his grandfather, also Rabbi Baumol, who he talks about often. But that's correct. His uncle, Rabbi Baumol of the Crown Heights Yeshiva, was extremely important. Rabbi Lamb represented the first generation of American-born rabbis. This also is interesting. Rabbi Lamb's greatness in YU was the Rabbi Lamb transition between the European generation and the American generation. This question about is halacha relevant. The sermons Rabbi Lamb delivered to the Jewish Center were very much American sermons, and that's a very important point of this. Given his position on halacha that you just read, what was Rabbi Lamb's and generally the point of view of modern Orthodoxy in the 70s on Das Torah? They didn't even know what Das Torah meant, right? I mean, that was not an issue in the Haredi community, the Rashi Yeshiva were not factors within modern Orthodoxy. The average modern Orthodox person in the Jewish Center didn't even know who Rav Aaron Cutler was. Lamb legacy or Lamb heritage? I thought Lamb legacy, but if it's Lamb heritage, then you know better than I do. I don't think anybody used the term Das Torah then. That's correct. Okay. I heard many of Rabbi Baumol's sermon at the Yeshiva of Crown Heights in the 60s and can attest to the quality of his oration. Rabbi Baumol, I'll tell you Rabbi Baumol's story. Rabbi Baumol once told me the following story. Rabbi Baumol told me he became the principal of Crown Heights, but the rabbi of the shul in the Crown Heights Yeshiva. And he told me that was in the, I think that was in the 30s, in the 1930s. And he took the job and there was mixed seating in the shul in the Crown Heights Yeshiva. He told me that when he used to go see Dr. Revel, that was before 1940, it was Dr. Revel was the president of Yeshiva University, that Dr. Revel refused to shake his hands. Because he was the rabbi of a shul with mixed seating, Dr. Revel refused to shake his hands. And one Friday morning, he told me, there was a bris in the Crown Heights Yeshiva. And he thought this is the perfect opportunity to build mechitza. He says, if you build mechitza for Shabbos, then people are going to, you know, get all upset when they come in on Shabbos morning. But if he builds the mechitza for a bris on Friday, then the mechitza will have been built already, just will remain for Shabbos. He stayed up all night with the woodworker. They built the mechitza. They had a mechitza for the bris on Friday, and the mechitza remained. And you talked about hearing the sermons. That's the history of the mechitza in the Yeshiva of Crown Heights. He was a man of tremendous dignity. If he was even in his old age in the old age home, he was a man of tremendous dignity. If my memory is correct, Yeshiva University filed with the state of New York to become a diversified yeshiva. My verbiage is not accurate, but there was turmoil in the yeshiva over this issue. That is correct, and there was an issue back in the 1960s, not for this topic. Not for today, but a good topic. But yes, they allowed the essay to be published in the yearbook. I would expect that the yeshiva could have prevented the essay from being published in the yearbook. That's correct, and you call me out, because actually, I probably should have called Rabbi Billet and asked what the history was. How is it possible they banned the yearbook, but they allowed it? I mean, you know, my simple answer, and the reason I didn't call Rabbi Billet, was I imagine that the students decided what was published in the yearbook, and the school didn't have a say in that decision. But your point is a very good point. I accept that. Yet produced important modern Orthodox leaders like Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Avi Weitz, Mark Dratch, Jay Kelman. I agree with all of that. I'm not sure exactly what I'm not sure exactly what that was in reference to. I would just say that Rabbi Shlomo Riskin and Avi Weiss and Rabbi Mark Dratch and Jay Kelman, without giving away anybody's age, they represent two different generations in Yeshiva University. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, and it's interesting, just to comment on this, that Rabbi Heshi Billet falls right in the middle. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin and Avi Weiss are one generation. Rabbi Heshi Billet is 10 years younger than they are. And Rabbi Mark Dratch and Rabbi Jay Kelman are 10 years or 10 years plus younger than they are. So actually, your point is a good point. Lauren's point is a very good point. But you should just know that represents three different moments in Yeshiva University and three different moments. The Shlomo Riskin Avi Weiss moment is one. The Heshi Billet moment is one. And the Mark Dratch Jay Kelman is another one. As a result of Orthodox communities in cities like Toronto, property houses value go up. We know that in those areas, of course. I was in a group of 20 boys from Chutz Laretz out of only 120 yeshiva, which was much smaller than it is today. You see, I mean, I want to say something to Mel, and that is your point is a great point. And that is, and I don't know enough about this, and this is a really important point, and that is the generation pre-1967 that spent the year in Israel. You know, what brought them to spend the year in Israel? Were they very Aliyah-oriented? Did they come from certain kinds of families? Did they come from certain high schools? I don't know what it was, because it was difficult to spend a year in Israel in those years. And they actually went and they spent a year in Israel. I know someone, Professor Jerry Blitzstein from Ben-Gurion, who actually spent a year after high school or a year after high school in Israel in the 1950s. And, you know, that's a tremendous Mesiras Nefesh to do that and to, you know, to study in Israel, you know, reflected, you know, Zionism with which they were brought up. But it's a very interesting question. I was the first student from Yeshiva High School for Central Brooklyn, I don't know what that all stands for, from Central Brooklyn to go to Mechlala in 1971. It was considered very unusual. Thank you, Rachel. Okay, now that's interesting. So Rachel's saying that in 1971, that was very, that was unusual. My wife went to Mechlala in 1979, and then again in 1980. By her time, and you have to ask her, but by her time, there were other Americans. You know, it wasn't everybody, but there were plenty of American young women who went. But that's great, Rachel. 1971. Didn't know that that was the moment. Thank you, but there are many greater who should be mentioned first. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for your humility. Okay, very good. Anyway, 1 minute. Mark Steiner, who unfortunately passed away, and I took leave of absence from Columbia to go to Israel to learn, inspired by Rabbi Gettinger. Oh, that's amazing. I wanted to say that I close my three lectures on kind of glimpses into American history, into American Orthodoxy. And, you know, I tried at the beginning, the first one was about Rabbi Henkin, the second one's around about the founding of Maimonides, and the third was around 1971. And I want to thank everybody who's taken from their Sunday morning, and I really appreciate the fact that you even took from your Sunday morning of Father's Day to come and to listen. And I've learned a tremendous amount from everybody, from people's personal experiences, from people's insights, from people's correcting what I said. It's really fantastic. I know that we're in an age of Zoom, and therefore it gives opportunity for people who would not necessarily come together to come together. But Rabbi Kelman knew this phenomenon long before there was a pandemic, and he knew that this allowed people to come together in a really really unique kind of way. So I give a tremendous yishkayach to Torah in Motion and to Rabbi Kelman, and to all of you, thank you for participating. It's been a treat, and I look forward to seeing you guys very soon. Happy Father's Day, and have a good Sunday.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. I just feel like I want to mention, you mentioned how they wanted YU and Stern to come together. So when, of course, Rabbi Ari Berman, the current president of Yeshiva University, was inaugurated, if you remember in his speech, I found it so phenomenal that he spent 5, 6, 7 minutes of his inauguration speech about how he met his wife when he was in YU High School. There was
a mixer
between YU and Central. And obviously he was sending a very important message about, because those things don't happen anymore. And there used to be, I understand in the 40s and 50s, or a time that they used to, people would bring their boyfriends and girlfriends would come together, why you? And there was a, this is a, Balazsian wasn't quite like that, you know.
I think that's probably right. Anyway, that point is very good. Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, and be well, and hope to see you soon.